From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And all eyes were on New York last night because that's when the statewide requirement that all healthcare workers get the COVID-19 vaccine in order to work went into effect. There was a real question about whether or not those still holding out at hospitals and nursing homes would actually get the shot. David Robinson is a healthcare reporter covering New York State for the USA Today Network. So, David, what happened?
Yeah, so really what happened was in the past week or so, there was a tense showdown that unfolded in New York State between Governor Kathy Hochul and the tens of thousands of medical workers at hospitals and nursing homes who have remained unvaccinated against COVID-19. And New York State had announced a vaccine requirement that these workers receive at least the first dose by September 27th, and that was yesterday. And really not much happened. There was a steady climb in the vaccination rate amongst medical workers from mid-August into September. But in this last week or so, last couple weeks, really, there was a mad dash here, it seems, amongst medical workers to comply with the vaccine mandate as opposed to losing their jobs over it. And
right.
So thousands of nursing home workers and hospital workers went and got the shot as a result of the vaccine mandate. There's also, on the other side, there's, you know, the numbers are still early, but close to 45,000 medical workers who have yet to comply. Some of those would be placed on unpaid suspension, you know, given some time to potentially reconsider so that they can keep their jobs. Others have outright been terminated or resigned.
Yeah.
And so I think really what's going to be unfolding here in the coming days in New York is really the contingency plans to try and fill the gaps of those nursing home workers and hospital workers who did choose to forego a vaccination and lose their jobs.
Well, yeah, well, I want to talk about those plans, but just to underscore what you're saying, even though now more than 92% of hospital employees in New York State have had at least one dose, complying with the mandate that they do so by yesterday. As you said, 45,000 haven't. And we've seen, you know, some of the pockets, Staten Island, you know, across the bridge from Manhattan. We see nurses holding up signs. So there are pockets of real resistance to this. What are they saying to you? Do they just not believe that the vaccine works? I mean, they're on the front lines. They're dying from COVID.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken with quite a few workers who've chosen to get the vaccine and those who chose not to over the past 9 months or so. And you know, it's reflective of what some of the sentiments in the general population are to some degree. I mean, there's people who just really now, you know, consider it a personal choice and medical freedom narrative
yeah.
that seems to be emerging. So I think it really is reflective. I mean, these are healthcare workers who are on the front lines and they do have access to more information. And there are hospitals and nursing homes who spent months who will tell you that they have teams who have been trying to address questions, trying to convince these people over time. You know, the hospitals and nursing homes are saying that does seem to be part of this kind of slow trickle of convincing people to get the shots in the
right.
past months. But really that last scramble, it seems, can be attributed to the mandate, really,
right.
just holding their feet to the fire.
And what are the governor and maybe the New York City mayor, what are some of the contingency plans you mentioned, 45,000 workers? By the way, is it assumed they'll all be fired? I mean, what happens to them? And then what's the plan for replacing them?
So potentially there's hundreds, if not thousands, who are in a holding pattern as far as the status of their religious exemption claim.
Mm.
There's also those who would be given some time to reconsider. I think, you know, there's been definitely some large health systems who've said that they would welcome them back if they'd comply in the next, you know, week or in coming days, really, coming weeks. The other element of that is these emergency contingency plans that the governor is putting out there, potentially deploying the National Guard, some of the medical staff and the National Guard to fill gaps, bringing in workers, trying to attract workers from other states, other countries like Ireland and the Philippines. There's calls for calling back retirees. A lot of the same policies that are reminiscent of the peak pandemic weeks and months last spring in New York when the call went out to try and bring in health workers. So really, there's several unknowns as far as kind of what's going to happen next. And I think there's a lot of attention on New York as far as kind of how this plays out as the federal
yeah.
vaccine mandate is looming over the country in the background.
Well, then the state mandate seemed to have worked to a certain extent. David Robinson, healthcare reporter covering New York State for the USA Today Network. David, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, throughout the country, a movement of first responders, firefighters, and policemen and women are also standing up against the vaccine mandates. Los Angeles was one of the first to require its employees to get vaccinated, and now firefighters and police officers are suing the city to block the mandate. Kevin McBride is the attorney for the group representing firefighters. They're called Firefighters for Freedom, and Kevin McBride joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
The city has ordered workers to be fully vaccinated by October 5th. What do your clients hope to achieve by suing?
Well, my clients are absolutely intent on stopping the mandate.
Firefighters are on the front lines in contact with people, as we know.
Right.
Why do they want to stop something that medical experts say will keep them safe?
Medical experts recently, the recent evidence does not suggest that vaccines are the way to keep people safe. Firefighters wear protective equipment on every call they go on. That's been before COVID, after COVID. So when firefighters go into a building, they're fully have full protective equipment that stops anything from their body from transmitting to a person in the room. That's the best way to stop transmission. So back to your statement that medical experts say that vaccinations are the best way to stop transmission, the evidence now having to do with the Delta variant is just the opposite. And that's what we're focusing on.
Right. Well, the science actually shows us that vaccinations do help stop the spread of coronavirus. The city mandate requires vaccines or weekly testing. Medical or religious exemptions are allowed. What's unreasonable about that? I'm hearing what you're saying about them wearing equipment, but what's unreasonable about getting vaccines or weekly testing?
Weekly testing is fine. The problem is the vaccines, and the evidence we have in Los Angeles County is that from May to July of this year, 43,000 cases of COVID were reported. 10,855 of those were in fully vaccinated people. That's 25%.
I hear what you're saying, Kevin.
Kevin,
what I hear you say is that the science is wrong. The science also shows us that not only does the vaccine slow the spread of the virus, it also helps reduce severity. So we won't get into that argument here.
Well, that's our argument. So we have to get into it, Tanya. I mean, that's our argument.
The bottom line, though,
that's
Kevin,
the heart
is
of
that
our
there
issue.
Are consequences.
We can't avoid it.
Can I ask you the question? So there are consequences, though, for workers who refuse. That's the bottom line. The ordinance says that workers are ineligible for promotion or transfer until they're fully vaccinated. So there's actually some teeth to this here. Are firefighters talking about quitting?
No, firefighters are not going to quit. They're going to show up for work. We're suing to stop this illegal mandate under the California Constitution that gives firefighters a right to privacy, which the city is absolutely ignoring.
There's an LA fire captain who's under investigation right now after he posted a video on YouTube outlining his objections, apparently while on duty at a station. But the head of the United Firefighters of Los Angeles City, Local 112, says most city firefighters are actually vaccinated. So again, why fight this in court at this point?
Well, that's not true. 58% are. 58%, that's the data.
Again, why fight this in court if over half of the population of firefighters in LA are vaccinated?
I mean, the Constitution provides for individual rights. It's really important to also recognize community rights. Firefighters know that better than anybody. What the Constitution requires is a balancing between individual rights and group rights. That's what we're aiming for, the reasonable middle ground between individual rights and the community rights.
What are some middle ground steps?
Well, you mentioned one of them, and I mentioned one. Certainly testing is a good middle ground. Certainly protective equipment for firefighters and first responders is a good middle ground. And screening is a good step. So just for example, as a common sense matter, firefighters, if they wake up in the morning and don't feel well, are asked not to go to work.
I'm thinking about the union here. Other firefighters aren't exactly on the same page with this. The International Association of Fire Chiefs has expressed support for mandatory vaccinations. The International Association of Firefighters and local leaders of Local 112, as I mentioned, support vaccines, but they don't think that they should be mandated. Do you think unions will win out here?
Well, I wish this were not a fight of who's going to win. What I wish it were was a negotiation with the city, with the fire, with the union, with everybody involved, to find a way to actually achieve the purpose of the ordinance. The purpose of the ordinance says to protect the public. That's what we should keep our eye on. And we should sit down and discuss and explore with medical experts from every side of the table the best way to stop the spread of vaccine in Los Angeles County. That should be the objective. So I don't pretend to know what all the steps are, but I do think that's something that both sides should sit down and identify and bargain over.
Kevin McBride represents the group Firefighters for Freedom, a group of Los Angeles firefighters who are suing to block the city's vaccine mandate. Kevin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure, Tanya. Thank you.
And a note, the vaccines are completely effective in preventing death from COVID-19. Experts say that hundreds of thousands of deaths have been prevented by COVID vaccines in the U.S. The vaccines are also very effective at preventing infections. But of course, they cannot prevent all infections.
While Texas attracted a lot of attention with its new law banning abortions after around 6 weeks, before most women know they're pregnant, it's a Mississippi law that's on the docket before the Supreme Court. In 2018, Mississippi banned most abortions after 15 weeks, earlier than the around 24-week date set by a 1992 Supreme Court decision. But an appeals court blocked the Mississippi ban from being enforced. Now Mississippi is asking the Supreme Court to overturn that block, allow their state law banning abortions after 15 weeks, which would overturn the court's own 1992 decision, again of 24 weeks. And Mississippi is also asking the court to overturn Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision that established a woman's constitutional right to an abortion. Now, many have joined the case with legal briefs, including a group of more than 500 female athletes who say denying access to reproductive rights keeps female athletes from excelling, not just in sports, but in strengthening their communities. Among the signers, soccer stars including Megan Rapinoe, basketball greats Sue Bird, Brittany Griner, and Brianna Stewart, and Olympic gold medal-winning swimmer Chrissy Parham, who also says in the brief that she terminated a pregnancy as a teenager. Chrissy Parham joins us now from New Mexico. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thank you for having me on.
Well, this is an interesting and, for many people, very powerful argument. So make yours. What are you saying with this brief and with your own story?
Thank you for asking it that way, because I'm just sharing my story. When I was 19, I was a sophomore in college at the University of Arizona, and I was engaged to be married. And over Christmas break, early January, I found out I was pregnant. And even though I was engaged and, you know, wanted to have a family with this person I was marrying, I knew that it wasn't the right time for me.
And this was a birth control failure.
Yeah.
So tell us about making that decision. What was behind your decision?
I just knew that I wasn't ready to be a mom, even though, and honestly, I probably wasn't ready to be married as well. But I knew I wasn't ready to be a parent. I had struggled my first year of college, and I was still very much struggling as a sophomore. And I knew that I had the option because of Roe v. Wade, and so I chose to have an abortion.
Okay. You go on to say you, Chrissy, were given a second chance at life.
Absolutely. Not only was I not ready to be a parent, I feel like this was a chance for me to reevaluate the choices that I was making, how seriously I was taking my studies, how seriously I was taking my swimming. And it kind of was a wake-up call for me to straighten my life out and either change my behavior and grow from it, or, you know, I would possibly be giving up college and being a young mom, and I wasn't ready for that.
Well, and you decided to really focus on goals, like your swimming, and you won your first national championship soon after that summer, and went on to win 3 medals, including 2 golds at the Barcelona Games in 1992. You put this all in the filing.
Yes, because that you know, and I hate to use the word epiphany or wake up call or whatever, but for me, that's absolutely what it was. I was letting myself down with my behavior that had nothing to do with accidentally getting pregnant. So it really was a wake up call, and it massively paid off for me, and not in the, oh, you had an abortion, then you became a winner. Like, that's not it. It's that I started working hard, being a better teammate, being a better daughter, being a better friend, and the good stuff happened down the line.
Yeah. Well, we should say, too, just part of that, what happened, that you were able to be a better mother when you became one.
Exactly. To have the opportunity to choose when I was going to be a mom was a huge blessing. And from the moment I found out I was pregnant with Alex to the moment he took his first breath, that was a blessing to me. And then 8 years later, I got to have Ryan by choice. I was older and more mature and ready to be a mom.
You were one of the athletes on this brief who signed your name to this. You are not anonymous, as some of the women are. This is very private for some people. I'm wondering if you're getting feedback that can be very tough. I mean, this is a very divisive issue. So I'll even throw out something that, you know, maybe you have heard. What do you say to people who might say, that sounds selfish? You may have gotten a second chance at life, but a being didn't get a first chance so that you could get gold medals.
Mm-hmm. Well, I respect other people's decisions, just like I would hope they would respect mine. So I understand that point of view, but it is law. I didn't break any laws, and I did what's best for me. And in the long run, I think that made me a better citizen, a better grown-up. I mean, I don't want to go too far into justifying one choice that I made at 19, but I'm 51, and I think that the 30 years plus since then, I've done more than prove that, you know, that I made the right decision for myself.
Yeah.
As for hearing from people, my phone started beeping 5 minutes after 5 a.m. Mm. Old work colleagues, old friends, old teammates, people that I'm still very close to now were reaching out. My children are really proud of me, and I do feel really supported and loved. And like I said, I don't feel like I need to go back 30 years to justify my behavior. Mm-hmm. But I was very stressed for the last 3 or 4 days. It is a private situation, and people aren't really entitled to my private decisions, whether I choose to have a child or not, how I vote. But what I felt like this morning was I had ripped a Band-Aid off, and I was really scared about the wound that was going to be underneath, and there really wasn't one.
Hmm.
Not that I'm proud of having an abortion. What I'm proud of is I weighed the pros and cons, I talked to my partner, and it set me on a path that changed my life for the better.
Yeah. Why do you think this is resonating so much with athletes? In the brief, it says that losing reproductive rights would be devastating for women's athletics and for society as a whole, but for female athletes, why do you think that is?
Well, I think for the most part, the thing that's so unique about reproductive rights is it's really just only 50% of the athletic community. But I also feel like the window for being an elite athlete for a woman is a small window. There are more opportunities now. Since I was an athlete, you know, we have the WNBA, we have soccer, you can be a professional swimmer, and you can run track and you know, as we saw over the Olympics and with Allison Felix, be a mom and come back. But the window when I was there was much, much smaller. And so I think that's kind of why we feel like it's imperative for those of us that have already walked that walk as student athletes, that we make sure that that path is still open and available to the women who for 4 or 5 years want to be the best student athletes that they can be. And then if they do want to go on to something and continue their sport, they have that option. But if they don't, they got to compete in the prime of their life just like the men do.
Which leads to, as the brief says, greater educational success, career advancement, enhanced self-esteem, improved health. I mean, isn't just... Not everybody gets gold medals like you do.
Oh, right. This is not about the Olympics. And when I made the choice at the time, I was not on the radar of even being a national champion, let alone becoming an Olympian. You're right. This is absolutely not about, you know, if you get an abortion, you can be an Olympian. That is not what I'm saying at all. Yeah. It's giving women an opportunity to have body autonomy to do their sport at the peak and with their teammates.
Yeah. A lot of signees, but also group signed. The Women's National Basketball Players Association, the National Women's Soccer League Players Association. And it sounds, too, as if you are doing this for other girls down the road.
I think that's the point of the brief. This is body autonomy rights, reproductive rights, healthcare choices, and we want the girls behind us to have the exact same choices that we did. My mom was also a college athlete. She did two sports in college. She played basketball and she played volleyball, and they wore the same uniforms for that sport. They also drove themselves to their games and their matches.
Yeah.
I did not have to do that. I got to fly to my swim meets. I was supported by my university. The women before me made choices and stood up for themselves so that I could have those opportunities. And I absolutely feel like it is my job to do the same for the people behind me.
Yeah. Chrissy Parham, one of more than 500 athletes who signed on to a brief to try to convince the Supreme Court to uphold a federal court ruling that blocks a Mississippi abortion ban. In other words, they spoke out in favor of reproductive rights. Chrissy, thanks so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time to speak on your show.
It's a topic that elicits a lot of thoughts, and if you have some you want to share, please send us an email, letters@hereandnow.org. Holiday shopping could look different this year. Walmart is giving up its layaway program in favor of a buy now, pay later model. Peloton, Amazon, Macy's, they're all offering similar options. And they're using financial companies like Affirm and Klarna, which allow customers to take home the purchase immediately and pay it off in installments. Robin Farzad is the host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, you know, in preparing for this, layaway does seem like such a quaint idea. You know, your grandma would buy something and the whole family would go look at it in the store window. That's going to be ours someday,
yeah.
You know, because it stayed there until you could pay for it. And we're a society that wants things now. But tell us about Affirm. Walmart is partnering with Affirm. How does that program work?
Buy now, pay later. I mean, it's like consequence-free bacon. What's not to love? You know, you have a slate of newfangled venture-backed payment facilitators acting as a middleman between the retailer and the consumer who is credit maxed. So you take a purchase, let's say it's a $500 mattress, and after, say, a 25% immediate down payment, you work out an installment plan of payments, most typically interest-free. In theory, Robin, this is all done outside of the traditional, often treacherous credit card, credit rating check system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so is that, start with benefits, because it does seem too good to be true. Is that one of the benefits that if you're doing this just on your credit card and, you know, the interest piles up if you don't pay, what happens with Affirm?
I mean, look, there are gallons and gallons of fine print. Consumer groups are already warning that this is a slippery slope for younger consumers who lack personal finance experience and can fall into a debt trap. Are you spending more than you can afford? What about the penalties for late payment? What's the tripwire for getting it reported to a credit rating agency? I mean, the old way was you'd show up freshman year at college and your mailbox would be full of these credit card solicitations. There's this tipping point now that's thinking that these younger generations are looking for a different solution.
Well, and talk more about these programs. Okay, the upside, you can have this buy now, pay later. But if there's not a fee or something, how are those companies making money? I mean, Klarna is valued at $46 billion.
Yeah, they profit by docking a fee from the merchants whenever a customer consummates a transaction. And they can show that their option often empties carts with items left in them more often than the old credit card option. And late fees can pad profits even more, assuming you don't have to write down too many deadbeat transactions. Still, despite its fat valuation, Klarna is still posting a loss to the tune of $109 million. So it's still in startup phase.
Okay. Look, according to CNBC, 42% of Americans have fallen into credit card debt since March 2020. It's like, buying things from home, you know, just to keep ourselves going. Do you see another slippery slope here?
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember, Robin, when trans fats were innovative ways of avoiding unhealthy fats until it was learned that trans fats were themselves dangerous. I mean, what happens in a recession if you see a spate of personal bankruptcies? Even so, right now in this environment, already a third of U.S. consumers who used Buy Now, Pay Later services have fallen behind on one or more payments, and nearly three quarters of those said their credit score declined. This is all according to a recent study by Credit Karma. So I don't think it's a panacea.
Yeah, well, and I'm not sure we're going to go back, though, to layaway, where you go look longingly in the window to the
rain
couch.
Rain checks at Zaire. What happened?
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Murders are up in our country, and not just in big cities. Places like Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Syracuse, New York saw an uptick. And nationwide, murders were up nearly 30% in 2020, according to new FBI data. That's the largest one-year increase on record. Joining us now is Richard Rosenfeld, criminologist and emeritus professor of criminology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Richard, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
The police chief in Albuquerque said they experienced a perfect storm of reasons why the city saw an increase in murders. What stands out to you about this data?
Well, I think there are two stories in the recent report released by the FBI. One, as you mentioned, is the striking increase in homicide rates in 2020 over the previous year. But the other story is the overall decline in serious crime in the United States, which continues a trend that has existed for many years now.
I want to get into both of those threads, but first I want to talk about murders nationwide. According to the FBI, we saw more than 21,000 murders nationwide in 2020. One of the reasons was the increase in gun use, and we actually saw a surge in gun sales in 2020. Do you see a correlation there or causation?
I do. There are a couple of things to mention. One is that 77% of homicides last year were committed with a firearm. And that's the single largest fraction of homicides committed with a gun on record. Secondly, as you mentioned, there was a significant surge in gun sales, and police departments around the country have been reporting that they're recovering more illegally possessed firearms from the streets than they have in the past. All of that suggests that there's more gun carrying in our cities in particular. So the upsurge in firearm availability and firearm carrying is clearly a contributor.
One thing of note is that murders didn't go up just in major cities. As I mentioned, it went up in smaller cities too. Tell us more about what's happening around the country on this particular thread.
I think some of us were not all that surprised by the FBI's reporting that homicide rates were up. What is striking, though, is how widespread that increase is. It's not simply the big cities that have experienced a major increase in homicide. It's smaller cities, towns, and even rural areas. That is striking. So when you see a rise that is so widespread, you begin looking for conditions that are comparably widespread. Last year, there were two conditions that stand out. One, of course, is the pandemic, and the second is widespread protest activity, social unrest directed at police violence, and beginning after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May of 2020.
As you noted, there was not a spike in crime across the board last year. And even this increase in murders, while it is alarming, the number of murders has fallen significantly since the early 1990s. Can you put that increase into context for us?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. We are facing a single year major spike in homicide. Nonetheless, we're still looking at homicide rates that are much lower than they were in the late 1980s and early 1990s. That's not cause for complacency, but it does suggest that that major crime drop has not been upended. Nonetheless, we have a problem with the increase in homicide, and that problem has to be effectively addressed.
Well, what worked to bring down that soaring violent crime rate in the early 1990s? And will some of those tactics work today? I mean, policing has evolved somewhat since then.
Policing certainly has evolved. I think there were two major factors that contributed to the decline we saw beginning in the early 90s. One was a roaring economy. And better economic conditions clearly contributed to the crime drop. The other factor was a change in policing, and specifically devoting police resources to those relatively small areas in our cities and other places that account for disproportionately for violent crime, including homicide. That's the so-called hotspot strategy. And I think it's clear that that has contributed or did contribute to the drop in homicide and other crimes we saw during the 90s. Now, one cannot simply increase police presence in disadvantaged minority communities in particular unless that increased presence is accompanied by a commitment to fairness and that it doesn't simply amount to increased police presence that would harass young men in the community without providing protection and safety for community residents.
Richard Rosenfeld is a criminologist and emeritus professor of criminology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, nearly every automaker is working on developing electric cars right now. And while there are benefits, there are also downsides. The batteries needed for electric cars use certain metals, and mining them can be dangerous and harmful to the environment. Prachi Patel of IEEE Spectrum spoke with one company that wants to mine in the deep sea.
Electric vehicle batteries today rely on a handful of metals like nickel, cobalt, copper, and manganese. Last year, the mining industry generated 190 billion tons of waste, almost 100 times more than municipal waste. And Gerard Barron, the CEO of the metals company in Canada, says metal mining is ramping up.
We've realized that to meet the needs of this transition away from fossil fuels, that extractive industries, mining, will need to increase output by 500 to 600% per year. So the impact of increased metal extraction is going to be enormous.
So Barron and his colleagues set out to develop an alternative to mining mountains and caves. Turns out large zones of the ocean floor, 4,000 meters deep, are packed with metallic nodules containing exactly the metals needed for batteries. And Barron plans to harvest them.
They form in potato-sized little lumps, and they literally sit on the ocean floor. And so it means the process of harvesting them is a whole lot simpler.
The company's robotic collector will slowly move along the seafloor and fire jets of seawater across the tops of the nodules to gently dislodge them. There's no need to blast mountains or dig huge pits, and much less life to harm, he says, than clearing the rainforests of Indonesia, where most of the world's new nickel supply will come from. Land-based mining has plenty of other issues too, says Kwesi Ampofo, head of metals and mining at research firm Bloomberg NEF.
If you take nickel mining in Indonesia, for instance, there has been consistent cases where companies are opting for deep sea tailings disposal, where at the end of the mine processing, the waste that is generated is deposited in the sea.
This waste often contains arsenic or mercury. Those toxic heavy metals can shorten the lives of fish and other animals, affect their reproduction, and even kill them. Plus, mining on land takes a lot of energy.
The quality of the ore body and deposits in the ocean is significantly higher than those we find on Earth. So what that means is that you're going to find out that the energy intensity to extract these metals will be lower than its counterparts on Earth.
But Ampofo says it's unclear what impact mining the oceans will have on local marine life. Craig Smith, an oceanographer at the University of Hawaii, says what these deep oceans lack in quantity of life, they make up for in sheer diversity.
In single areas, we've found more than 2,000 species of a variety of different kinds of animals, not counting the microbes.
Smith says it will be impossible to mine nodules on a commercial scale without severely impacting sensitive, pristine deep sea habitats. The damage to the seafloor ecosystem, he says, will be permanent.
It's important to pursue this kind of mining activity incrementally. I strongly feel we should only license one mining operation and study it for decades until we really understand what the impacts are.
The metals company hopes to get that license. For now, they are spending over $75 million on research to understand ocean mining's ecological impact and how best to minimize it. The second of five research expeditions for this year is currently underway. For Here and Now, I'm
More than 2 million Americans are affected by a condition known as aphasia. That's according to the National Aphasia Association. My mom had it after a fall, hitting her head. The good news, she didn't really know. She just kept chatting with us. It didn't make much sense. Kind of bittersweet. Well, aphasia is a condition that occurs after someone suffers a brain injury, typically a stroke, and they lose the ability to speak or read and communicate. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Jill Ryan reports on one way to help bring back the language and create a social community, singing.
When Dominic Villanfuso had a stroke in 2014, it would take him 2 years before he learned to speak again. A lover of books and a career editor at Simon & Schuster, he soon found it almost impossible to continue following his passions.
When I had a stroke, the first thing was horrible. People weren't helping me. People didn't talk to me.
I see trees.
But what you're listening to is what he's been doing since. Dominic is a member of the International Aphasia Choir, a project in which people from all over the world come together to sing in at least one video a year. Its first virtual video performance made its debut in November with dozens of participants from five continents. One of the co-founders of the International Choir is Jillian Velmer, a speech-language pathologist. Velmer says having aphasia can be isolating.
It's a language disorder that can affect reading, writing, and speaking, but it typically does not affect intellect or a person's memories.
Velmer is also the founder of the Sing Aphasia Choir, which, while physically based in New Jersey, has moved online because of the pandemic. Her choir now has members from all over the country, and her mission is to become a resource for people trying to start their own aphasia choirs. She says certain songs, hopeful, popular, but especially repetitive ones, like All You Need Is Love by the Beatles, are the best to use. If the words are too hard, Velmer encourages participants to sing on.
You can sing on like la la la, or you can hum, or you can just sing like the one part, All You Need Is Love.
All you need is love, love, love is all you need.
And it repeats over and over, so it's really good practice for their speech articulation, too.
Corianne Rogalski, a cognitive neuroscientist with Arizona State University, explains the science behind the singing. She says song and speech are actually quite different. Take the artist Adele, for example.
Never mind.
If you listen to her sing, we don't hear her British accent. But when she speaks, she has a very sort of, you know, characteristic accent of where she's from. And why is that the case? It's because her brain and my brain, but her brain to a much better extent, treats music and speech very differently.
So when it comes to stroke survivors and other brain injury patients who may have trouble speaking,
many of them can sing much better than they can speak. It may not be perfect, but there's a huge boost.
Rogalski says caregivers and loved ones also can improve understanding with someone with communication impairments by changing the way they speak to them.
There's maybe exaggerated pitch changes at important parts of the sentence, or for some individuals, is actually removing all that distracting musical information and just going like this.
So when it comes to aphasia choirs, Velmer says it's more than just a therapy. What a wonderful
world. And while I'm a speech language pathologist and I may be using some strategies to help facilitate communication, I don't call it speech therapy. We call it, it's our choir rehearsal.
Dominic Vienfuso, who participated in the International Choir Project, says singing is fun, even when it's not perfect.
This is so stupid, but we're having fun. And that's what it was. I just told everybody this is the worst thing in the world, but it's great. It's fascinating. Remember, we're smiling.
Velmer says aphasia choirs look different from choirs she's seen at a school or a church. Most notably, she says many members sit instead of stand, and not everyone may sing. The International Choir is currently in production of its second virtual video performance, and Sing Aphasia is continuing to have weekly rehearsals. For Here and Now, I'm Jill Ryan in Phoenix.
And that music is courtesy of the International Aphasia Choir, founded by Sing Aphasia and the company Neuromusic Therapy. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.